Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, April 22nd, 2024. President Joe Biden on this Earth Day goes to Triangle, Virginia to announce billions of dollars in grants for solar power and new steps for his American Climate Corps. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, responds to the Biden administration's preventing oil and gas drilling in a large part of the National Petroleum Reserve area of Alaska's North Slope. Supreme Court hears a case challenging an Oregon City ordinance restricting people, including the homeless, from camping or sleeping in outdoor spaces on the grounds it violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, renews her call to replace Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, after the House voted over the weekend for $95 billion in foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Members of Congress of both parties reacting to the pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University and other colleges that have led to arrests. Secretary of State Antony Blinken releases the annual country reports on human rights and is questioned about the report's conclusions that Israel committed serious human rights violations in 2023. And Terry Anderson, former journalist who was held hostage by militants in Lebanon for 6 years, has died. Story from CNN, President Joe Biden traveled to Triangle, Virginia Monday to mark Earth Day, unveiling $7 billion in grants funding for solar power under the Inflation Reduction Act and announcing new steps to stand up his administration's American Climate Corps, a program popular with youth climate groups. The announcements come days after the Biden administration made several significant conservation announcements, including banning oil drilling on nearly half of the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. President Biden touted his climate and clean energy record against a backdrop of green trees in Virginia. He called the climate crisis an existential threat that requires full and clear action. That was from CNN. Here's part of the president's remarks.
Energy costs are among the biggest costs for families to budget, particularly poor and middle-income families. In fact, low-income families can spend up to 30% of their paychecks on their energy bills. It's outrageous. Reduce family energy costs for folks with low and moderate incomes today, the Environmental Protection Agency will invest $7 billion from our Inflation Reduction Act in a new program called Solar for All. It will award grants, 60 grants across the country to states, territories, tribal governments, municipalities, nonprofits, to develop programs that enable low-income and disadvantaged communities to benefit from residential solar power. And it's a big deal. This new Solar for All program means that 900,000 households, 900,000, will have solar on the rooftops for the first time and soon. Millions of families will save over $400 a year in utility bills, and that's $350 million nationwide. My dad said it matters what's there at the end of the paycheck, but the month is out. Do you have anything left? It means we'll cut more than 5 million metric tons of carbon pollution annually. And folks, Solar for All will give us more breathing room and cleaner breathing room. It's going to also create 200,000 good-paying and union jobs over the five years in communities that need it most, fence line communities. You know, as I always say, I think about climate. When I think about it, I think not only about health and safety, but I think about jobs. And that brings me to my second announcement. Last fall, I talked about a historic new program that my administration was launching with the help of my colleagues on my right here, called the American Climate Corps. As I said, and I'm not being solicitous, Ed Markey talked about that long before. It's patterned after the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps. Like them, it brings out the best in young people to do what's best for America. And we'll put tens of thousands of young people to work at the forefront of our climate resilience and energy future, clean energy future. Today, I'm proud to announce that Americans across the country can now apply to become the first members of the American Climate Corps. We're recruiting for over 2,000 positions in 36 states to start with, in Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, with many on the way. Just go to Climate Corps, as mentioned already, climatecorps.gov to apply. You'll get paid to fight climate change, learning how to install those solar panels, fight wildfires, rebuild wetlands, weatherize homes, and so much more that's going to protect the environment and build a clean energy economy. To ensure a pathway to good union jobs and careers, you'll have access to free apprenticeship training through a new partnership we're announcing today with the North American Building Trades Unions. As you may remember, when I announced in 2020, I initially didn't announce my climate position until I talked to the unions, because unions were all, they thought climate cost them jobs. Well, guess what? IBEW stepped up, and they all stepped up, and now our strongest support comes from the unions. When you finish your service, you finish your term of service, you'll also be eligible for a streamlined path to federal government jobs related to climate and clean energy.
President Biden at Prince William Forest Park in Triangle, Virginia, on this Earth Day. Washington Examiner writes the president was joined on Monday by Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, Senator Ed Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts, and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, all three progressives and some of the loudest voices in Congress focusing on green energy. In a pre-Earth Day announcement, the story from HuffPost, President Joe Biden's administration on Friday safeguarded millions of acres in Alaska from fossil fuel drilling and mining, the latest in a frenzy of environmental actions in recent weeks that have drawn praise from green groups and condemnation from industry and Republican lawmakers. The Interior Department finalized a rule that bars oil and gas development across more than 13 million acres of the National Petroleum Reserve on Alaska's North Slope. Interior also moved to block construction of the Ambler Road, a proposed 211-mile mining road that would have cut through a portion of Alaska's pristine gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve to access billions of dollars worth of copper deposits. Both actions ultimately reversed decisions from Donald Trump's presidency. That was from HuffPost. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, spoke on the Senate floor on Friday about this. We pick it up with her comments about the oil and gas drilling.
The second action that we are anticipating from Interior tomorrow will be the finalization, the final rule, to shut down further access to our National Petroleum Reserve in the northwest portion of the state. This is a 23 million acre expanse. This is an area about the size of Indiana. There's only a few hundred acres of this Indiana size piece of the state that have ever been approved for any type of development. And it's exactly what the Obama-Biden administration had pointed to. They said to the oil and gas companies, go there. Go to the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Don't go to Anwar. Go over here. Develop there. So now you have the interest in it. And after approving exactly one significant project in our petroleum reserve, the Biden administration has now completely abandoned that approach. And what we expect to see tomorrow is Interior issuing just a sweeping rule to now cut off access. And to add insult to injury, without barely consulting the Alaska Natives who live on the North Slope, failed to consult, failed to violate their own policy. They didn't fail to violate, they violated their own policies. They ignored federal law. This is really tough for us in Alaska, because this is not the first time now that this administration has just turned their eye to what the law requires. They ignored federal law, which requires an expeditious program of competitive leasing and development. So where there was once opportunity, they're now creating uncertainty and restrictions that will cut off access and halt future projects. But again, never mind all that, the administration says, because it doesn't seem to matter to them. And that's what I don't get. Not the rule of law, not the local people who support responsible development, not the state benefits or the national need, not even the international events and the crises that we're dealing with right now at this moment that should have prompted a gut check. And maybe folks within the White House saying, maybe we should dial this back just a bit right now.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, on the Senate floor on Friday, ahead of Saturday's announcement from the Interior Department. The Secretary Deb Haaland in a statement saying the announcements underscore our commitment to ensure that places too special to develop remain intact for the communities and species that rely on them. Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican from Alaska, said on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday about the drilling ban on 13 million acres of the National Petroleum Reserve, quote, it's lawless. President Biden doesn't have the authority to do that, and I can go into all the laws that support me on that. It's, as I say, national security suicide. From the Washington Post, Supreme Court justices expressed concern on Monday about punishing homeless people for sleeping outside when they have nowhere else to go, while also struggling with how to ensure local and state leaders have the flexibility to deal with the growing number of unhoused individuals nationwide. The court's review of a set of Oregon anti-camping laws could lead to the most significant ruling on the rights of the unhoused in decades, with potentially sweeping implications for state capitals and city streets. Throughout the more than two-hour argument, the court's three liberal justices were most skeptical of laws passed by the city of Grants Pass that they suggested criminalize the most basic of human needs. But several conservative justices, who make up a majority of the court, suggested that policymakers and not judges should be setting local rules for dealing with homeless people. Some of the reporting from The Washington Post. One of those justices of the Washington Post, referred to as liberal, Ketanji Brown Jackson, asked this of the attorney for Grants Pass, Oregon, T&E Evangelis.
You say that the ordinance here pertains to conduct and not to status, and I'm just trying to figure that out. I'm not so sure for this reason. It's because all humans engage in the act in question, sleeping. And yet, the statute operates, or the ordinance operates, to penalize only certain individuals, those who have no choice but to do that act in public. So it appears, I think, not to be the act that the state, or the city in this case, finds criminally culpable. It's instead the act as engaged in by certain people, by people who cannot afford housing and have nowhere else to go. So why is that the wrong way to think about it? And if that is the right way to think about it, why isn't that a status crime in the way that Robinson contemplates?
It's not, because we can look at the law and it has a conduct element. The conduct is establishing a place, a campsite. And that is something that a person who has a home or a shelter
could do as well.
But you've
just defined away the basic actus reus, right? The actus reus is sleeping outside, I guess, outside, to the extent you put outside in it. But that's the problem I'm talking about. The actus reus is the sleeping. Right? Everybody, that's not a criminally culpable kind of activity. That's what I think might distinguish it from Robinson and make it worse for you in a way. Because in Robinson, at least, to the extent someone had a disease and the question was, well, are they engaging in otherwise criminally culpable conduct, buying and selling drugs, taking drugs, you know, we look at that kind of category of things. Here, the actus reus is sleeping. Human, universal. The city adds, okay, but you can't sleep outside. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is, to the extent that that only happens with respect to a certain category of people who have no other place to go, why isn't that really just punishing the status of being someone who doesn't have any place to go?
It doesn't apply only to those people. The respondents here are trying to exempt a whole category of people. What you look at there is the conduct of camping under federal law, and in this court's decision in Clark, it was understood that that is conduct. It is just like trespass, where if you are found in a place, if you enter with permission, but then you remain there without permission under Quarles.
But it's not just like trespass, because presumably you have other places to go.
Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson questioning attorney T&E Evangelis in the case City of Grants Pass, Oregon v. Johnson. The Robinson case that has been cited is from 1962, Robinson v. California. It struck down a California law making it a crime to be addicted to the use of narcotics. Another precedent mentioned is Powell. That's Powell v. Texas, 1968, brought by a man charged with a crime of being drunk in public who claimed he had an irresistible urge to drink. The court rejected that argument. More from today's oral argument. Here's Justice Neil Gorsuch questioning U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Edward Kneedler.
Mr. Kneedler, I agree that the distinction between status and conduct is a slippery one and that they're often closely related. And in Robinson, though, the court said you cannot make the status of being a drug addict a crime, but you can criminalize the conduct even if it is involuntary and compulsive. And Powell reaffirmed that line very strongly, at least the plurality opinion did, and said we're not going to go further. And I wonder whether the government is asking us to take that step that Powell counseled against by saying that it is status because effectively status, and this is throughout your brief, you use the word effective or essentially or tantamount to, those kinds of words. And so I just wanted to get your response to that concern.
No, we are not asking the court to take the step that it declined to take in Powell, which had to do with personal responsibility, the sort of issues that were involved in this court's decision.
Okay, if you're not asking us to do that, then I guess I just want to circle back to what Justice Thomas was getting at, which is surely the government wants to continue to enforce the drug laws and all kinds of other laws. That people could make an argument that I had involuntary need to do, a necessity defense to. You don't want us to wipe out all those laws.
Sir, absolutely not. But what is different here is that the conduct in that was suggested in Powell would have been based on the person's own separate antisocial conduct.
Well, Justice White made clear that some people are going to be forced to drink in public because they don't have a home. Yeah, he made this very point.
No, we don't. But the point here, it is the government that is prohibiting the alternative. It's not the individual's inability to control his own conduct. The government, because of other circumstances, the lack of money, the lack of a friend to stay with, the lack of shelter space, there is no place. We take as a given in our position that there is no other place for the person to
and
sleep.
And I think, couldn't a drug addict, though, make the exact same argument? I had no other choice.
But that the other choice would be a matter of personal undertaking,
the record
personal
says,
culpability.
But the record says that there is no other choice. I had to do it.
Well, I do think that in engaging in conduct that is unrelated to, let me take that back, the sleeping outside when you have no other place to go is the definition of homelessness.
U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Edward Kneedler, questioned by Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. Back to the Washington Post article about today's case. It began, they write, in Grants Pass, Oregon, after officials started strictly enforcing a set of measures that outlawed sleeping or camping in public spaces like parks and in parked cars, imposing fines ranging from $75 to $295. The penalties increased substantially when unpaid. It could eventually result in jail time or a park ban. Three homeless people, Deborah Blake, Gloria Johnson, and John Logan, sued Grants Pass in 2018, saying the city, with a population of 40,000 people, was punishing them unconstitutionally based on their status of being involuntarily homeless. They cited the Eighth Amendment's protections against cruel and unusual punishment. Again, from the Washington Post. And back to today's case, here is Justice Sonia Sotomayor asking the Grants Pass lawyer, Tiani Evangelis, about the Eighth Amendment.
You seem to start by saying that the Eighth Amendment is limited to forms of punishment and not to the nature of punishment, the proportionality issue. There also is a number of amicus brief that lays out for us that from the Magna Carta through the founding, through state laws, through Weems, which was in 1910, through Tropp, later in the century, that throughout all of that, both the English American colonies, this court, has had some form of proportionality in their Eighth Amendment jurisprudence. You're asking us to ignore all of that history.
No, we're not, Justice Sotomayor. What we are saying is that this case doesn't implicate proportionality. We're not asking the court to take a position on whether it's a proper inquiry under the Eighth Amendment. For example,
well, yes, you are, because you're saying that the only thing that's prohibited by the Eighth Amendment is a form of punishment. But in those cases, and in our history, we have said that certain punishments, CHOP, for example, can't be done.
That's right. And the court has always looked at if a particular punishment is considered too extreme or categorically so, as in the death penalty in some cases, the court looks at whether a lesser punishment would be acceptable. Again, it's looking at punishment. And that's where the inquiry focuses.
Attorney Tiani Evangelis, questioned by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor in today's case, City of Grants Pass, Oregon v. Johnson. You can find the full oral argument at our website, cspan.org. On Thursday, the Supreme Court will hear oral argument in Trump v. United States, asking whether former President Donald Trump is immune from criminal prosecution for his alleged role in trying to overturn the 2020 election results. He has been indicted federally for that. Live Thursday, 10 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN Television, streamed at cspan.org, and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. From the New York Times, prosecutors in the first criminal trial of an American president began laying out their case for a jury of 12 New Yorkers on Monday, saying Donald J. Trump engaged in a conspiracy to cover up a sex scandal in order to get elected president in 2016. The first witness called was the tabloid publisher David Pecker, whom prosecutors described as one member of a three-man plot to conceal damaging stories, including a porn star's account of a sexual tryst as Mr. Trump mounted his bid for the presidency. Mr. Pecker was on the stand for only a few minutes in the afternoon before court adjourned for the day. He described how his publication, The National Enquirer, paid for stories, a practice he called checkbook journalism. He's expected to return to the stand on Tuesday, reporting from the New York Times. The Congress is out of session today. The Senate returns Tuesday to take up the $95 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that the House passed on Saturday by a vote of 311 to 112 with one voting present. More House Republicans voted no than yes. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, has said that if Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, put Ukraine aid to a vote, she would make a resolution she's filed to remove Speaker Johnson privileged and force a vote on that. Today, she made the case for the motion to vacate on Steve Bannon's podcast, War Room.
I've not seen people this angry since November of 2020. I mean, they are off the charts angry. But there's a serious difference that I've observed. You know, in November of 2020, they were furious and they were invigorated to do something about it. And they wanted to defend our elections and they wanted to know what happened and what went wrong. And that launched a massive wave of election integrity across the country that America needed, desperately needed. There was a, you know, the fight is still going for election integrity. Thank God. But this time, Steve, this is different. They're angry on a whole nother level. And here's what really worries me. They're done with the Republican Party. They are absolutely done with Republican leadership like Mike Johnson, who totally sold us out to the Democrats, joined the Uniparty faster than anyone we've ever seen in history, and literally made a night and day change in a matter of months. Betrayed everyone, betrayed the entire Republican Party, betrayed Republican voters, betrayed the Republican Conference. And voters are so angry this time, but I'm really worried. I am really worried. They're so angry they're not going to give us the majority back in 2025. And this is why we absolutely have to hold Mike Johnson accountable. This is why our Republican majority is going to have to do the heavy lifting. And this is why he cannot remain Speaker.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, on the Steve Bannon podcast today. Congressman Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, chair of the Appropriations Committee, was on CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday talking about that vote the day before, aiding Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific, and Speaker Johnson's job.
there was a decision here for Speaker Johnson that was an important one. He basically put his job on the line. As we know, there's this movement among House conservatives led by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene to try to oust him from power, in part because of this Ukraine aid bill. Do you think this is a real threat to his leadership?
Well, I take anything seriously, but no, I don't. Look, I think it's a relatively small number of Republican members, frankly, just as it was in McCarthy's case. There were only eight people.
Exactly.
But the point is, I don't think there's unified Democratic support. There was unified Democratic support to remove the speaker. I think both sides have now seen how dangerous this is, how irresponsible it is. And quite frankly, I think it's unlikely that Democrats who supported Ukraine, not as many supported Israel as we would have liked, but they did support Ukraine. I think they're unlikely to remove the speaker over that. Although, to be fair, they removed McCarthy after he did what he asked them to do, which was keep the government funded. But again, I don't think that's going to happen in this case. But if somebody wants to do it, it's within the rules and they can take their shot.
But what you're saying there is that Democrats you trust would protect Speaker Johnson from being ousted because they wouldn't vote.
I don't think you'd lose very many Republicans. We didn't lose very many Republicans with McCarthy. So it doesn't take very many Democrats to either not vote or oppose it. And I don't, frankly, I don't think we'd lose the same number of Republicans that we lost with Kevin McCarthy. I think even people that disagree with the speaker.
You wouldn't get to eight Republicans.
I don't think so. Look, I think there's a lot of people that like this speaker, that respect the speaker, even when they disagree with him. They know he's honest. He's a straight shooter. They also had a taste of what it's like to go without a speaker for 3 weeks. Mm. I don't think they want that again. I certainly don't think they want it close to an election.
Congressman Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, chair of the Appropriations Committee, interviewed on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. Wall Street today, the Dow up 253, NASDAQ up 169, S&P up 43. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, which is free. Story from Politico, Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq is facing mounting calls for her resignation amid heightened unrest on her campus over the war in Gaza. More than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters have been arrested after refusing to leave an encampment resurrected on campus last week while Shafiq gave her testimony before the House Education Panel. Following Shafiq's more than three-hour questioning, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, Republican of New York, released a statement on Sunday saying Columbia University needs new leadership. President Shafiq must immediately resign. Several Republican and Democratic lawmakers joined Stefanik on Monday, including all of the New York House Republicans. That was from Politico. Two of those Republicans held a news conference outside Columbia University in New York City, Anthony D'Esposito and Mike Lawler. Here is Congressman Lawler.
Mom, Dad, I just killed 10 Jews with my bare hands. Those words were the words I heard when I visited Israel a month after October 7th and watched a 21-minute video, raw footage, unedited, of the Hamas terrorist attack on October 7th and listened to a young Palestinian man call home to his parents to say how he butchered 10 Jews with his bare hands. That level of hatred is taught. It's taught in the schools in Gaza. And unfortunately, we see it being taught on schools in America. Yeah. It is unacceptable and it must stop, and it must stop today. Yeah. Yeah. Every single one of these college and university presidents who refuse to take action should immediately resign in disgrace, and if they don't resign, their asses should be thrown out. I have never seen a more disgraceful act than what we are seeing on college campuses right now. I'm Irish, Italian, Catholic. I love this country. We are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation of many religions, many races, many ethnicities. Our country is the most free country in the world. And yet what we are seeing on these campuses is an absolute abomination. These children that are engaged in this anti-Semitic hate should be expelled immediately. Every last one of them.
Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, at a news conference with other elected officials at 116th and Broadway near Columbia University in New York City. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, whose daughter was one of the protesters arrested last week at Columbia University, posting on X today, "Throughout history, protests were co-opted and made to look bad so police and public leaders would shut them down. That's what we are seeing now at Columbia University. The Columbia protesters have made clear their demands and want their school not to be complacent in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Public officials and media making this about anything else are inflaming the situation and need to bring calmness and sanity back." Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, mentioned the protester today while introducing President Biden at his Earth Day event in Virginia.
"Today also serves as a reminder of the power of organizing, of what we can accomplish when young people, climate advocates, labor organizers, and working people of all backgrounds come together to demand the future we all deserve. It is especially important that we remember the power of young people shaping this country today, of all days, as we once again witness the leadership of those peaceful student-led protests on campuses like Columbia, Yale, Berkeley, and many others."
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York. Story from USA Today, as tensions over the Israel-Hamas war continue to boil on campuses across the country, Columbia on Monday moved classes online while dozens of students were arrested in protests at Yale, and Harvard officials closed Harvard Yard to the public. Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq said in a statement Monday that while online classes are being held, a working group of deans, university administrators, and faculty members will try to bring this crisis to a resolution by, among other actions, speaking with student protesters. That was from USA Today. A group of protesters were arrested today for blocking a Columbia University gate. This was off campus.
"Free, free, free Palestine!
Outside the gates, Columbia University, you heard a police officer say, "Lock them up," and there were arrests. Story from the New York Post, Columbia University professor who has been a vocal critic of the administration's response to the ongoing anti-Israel student protest, was barred from campus after he tried to lead a pro-Jewish rally at the Ivy League College. Israeli-born Shai Davidai, an assistant professor at Columbia Business School and an outspoken supporter of the Jewish state, said that when he swiped his key card at the school's Morningside Heights campus, it read "deactivated." He said administrators told him they banned him from campus because they could not ensure his safety. That was from the New York Post. A reporter recorded the scene.
"My card has been deactivated? Yeah. Why?
Can you back up, please?"
"Uh-huh. Wait. Everybody, my card has been deactivated. This is Cass Holloway, the COO. This is Gerald Lewis. They were in the meeting where I asked them if Hamas is a terror organization, and they couldn't say that it is a terrorist organization. Why? I'm a professor. Why can't I?"
"Shai,
speak out loud so the media
can hear. Shai, we are willing to take you to the math lawn."
No, I am a professor here.
We are columnists. We have a
Wait, everybody quiet.
I am a professor here. I have every right to be everywhere on campus. You cannot let people that support Hamas on campus and me, a professor, not go on campus. Let me in now.
Let us in.
No, no.
Shai Davidai today in New York City. Nearby at a news conference, New York City Deputy Police Commissioner for Legal Matters, Michael Gerber, was asked about that incident.
Today at the University of Professor was barred because they couldn't ensure his safety. Is the NYPD at any point, if the campus cannot ensure somebody's safety, is able to step in, or does that go back to
the commissioner goes?
Yeah, so the university makes decisions about who they let on their campus or don't let on their campus. For, you know, and they're doing their own analysis, making their own decisions, making their own safety determinations. That's not us. Again, they're a private university, private property. Those are their decisions, not ours. If someone is on campus and they are in physical danger, if they are about to be attacked, for example, we're going to respond immediately. Again, as we would in any location. But in terms of the decisions of the university in this regard, that's really a question for the university.
Michael Gerber, New York City Deputy Police Commissioner for Legal Matters, at a news conference today in the city. He also said that last week, when the arrests were made of the protesters on the campus of Columbia, the police were invited in by the school. Story from Jerusalem Post. Israel committed serious human rights violations in 2023, according to the U.S. State Department's Country Report on Human Rights Practices, which was released Monday afternoon. There were several credible reports that the government or its agents committed arbitrary or unlawful killings in 2023, the report said. There were also reports of disappearances by or on behalf of government authorities, mostly related to the war that broke out with Hamas's October 7th attacks. That was from the Jerusalem Post. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke at the release of the report today at the State Department in Washington, and then answered some reporters' questions.
I have two questions. One is about the report, but let me quickly go to your phone calls last night. You had two important phone calls with Israel's Benny Gantz and Yoav Gallant, who both strongly objected to upcoming punitive action from U.S. on specific Israeli military unit over human rights allegations. Have those phone calls changed your mind? When will you announce the action? And then coming back to the report again, in this report, you have a sentence saying Israelis operating in Gaza took no publicly visible steps to identify and punish officials accused of committing rights abuses. The accusations about IDF's military conduct in Gaza have piled up. They include using food as a weapon, targeting civilian infrastructure, indiscriminate bombing, something even the president has said is taking place. So I'm wondering, we know you've got ongoing processes about this, but could you tell us why is it taking so long to make a definitive assessment about these? And the fact that it's taking so long triggers, like, leads a lot of people suggesting that U.S. has a double standard when it comes to applying the law with Israel. Does the U.S. have a double standard? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Amira. Let me start with the last part of the question. Do we have a double standard? The answer is no. As this report makes clear, in general, as we're looking at human rights and the condition of human rights around the world, we apply the same standard to everyone. And that doesn't change whether the country in question is an adversary, a competitor, a friend, or an ally. And that's hugely important. With regard to the Leahy Law report that I think you were referring to at the outset, this is, a good example of a process that is very deliberate, that seeks to get the facts, to get all the information, that has to be done carefully, and that's exactly how we proceeded, as we proceed with any country that is the recipient of military assistance from the United States. And again, the same standard applies. I don't have more to say about it today, but I think you'll see in the days ahead that we will have more to say, so please stay tuned on that. On Gaza itself, a few things. First, from day one, we've been working to do everything we can to try to increase protection for civilians, as well as, to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance for the Gazans who so desperately need it. When it comes to allegations of incidents of, whether it's violations of international humanitarian law, rights abuses, you name it, we have processes within the department that are looking at incidents that have been raised. Those processes are ongoing. And here again, it's important that we take the time to do our best to get the facts, to get the information, to do the analysis. It's very challenging to do this in real time. And most of, as you'll see, if you look back at other places where we've made determinations ourselves, usually it takes time to do that to get the information.
Can you at least provide a timeline for any
of them? So I'm not going to give you a timeline except to say that these efforts are ongoing. And when we feel that we've made the, that we have the facts, we've been able to do the analysis, we'll make known the findings. Similarly, though, when we see reports of incidents, we also take these directly to, in this case, the Israeli government, and ask for an explanation, information about what did or didn't happen. That, too, is an ongoing process, and it's, I think, very important to make sure that countries know that we're watching this very, very carefully. But as I say, on the Leahy piece of this, more to come in the coming days.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken today at the State Department on the release of the annual country reports on human rights practices. Some more reporting on that from Voice of America. In the report's preface, the secretary first outlined Russia's invasion of Ukraine as a significant breach of human rights. He said the Kremlin's disregard and contempt for human rights are on full display, referencing its use of violence on citizens as a tool of warfare. He also discussed the civil war in Sudan as a significant threat to human rights, adding that both parties in the conflict have unleashed horrific violence, death, and destruction. And from Reuters, Beijing is continuing to commit genocide and crimes against humanity against Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in its western Xinjiang province. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a report published on Monday ahead of his planned visit to China this week. Terry Anderson, the globe-trotting Associated Press correspondent, became one of America's longest-held hostages after he was snatched from a street in war-torn Lebanon in 1985 and held for nearly 7 years, has died at 76. That story from AP. They go on. Anderson, who chronicled his abduction and torturous imprisonment by Islamic militants in his best-selling 1993 memoir, Den of Lions, died on Sunday at his home in Greenwood Lake, New York, said his daughter. Anderson died of complications from recent heart surgery, according to her. Terry Anderson was on C-SPAN in 2015 at a panel on journalists becoming hostages. It was held at the University of Arizona.
Terry, could you have covered Beirut from Cairo or from New York?
No, absolutely not. Look, the question really should be, do you want this information? You guys.
Yeah.
Do you think you need this to know about this, what's happening in the world? Okay. I think that it's important. I think you need to know it. And I think it's important enough that I have, in fact, risk my life to cover stories that I thought were important enough. Now, they're always, as I said before, they're always considered risks. I'm not a fool. I know that if I die, I'm not going to be able to file the story anyway. I need, and the process is every step of the way, not just when I sit in my office and say, I'm going to go do this, but when I get in the car, when I get there, and I get out of the car, every step of the way I'm weighing, is this worth it? If I'm going to go from here to there, and there's a chance somebody's going to shoot at me on the way, I damn well better believe there's something important enough for me over there that I need to do it. And that's the way journalists operate. They're not stupid. It is a risky profession. So is being a policeman. So is being a fireman. There are risky professions in the world, and there are people who do them because they think it's important enough to take the risks. I am passionate about the importance of journalists and journalism and the principles and the role that we play in any democratic system or free society. We are central You can't have a free society without a free press.
Terry Anderson, former Associated Press reporter and former hostage in Lebanon in the late 1980s on C-SPAN from our video library 2015 when he was a University of Florida journalism professor. It was hosted by the University of Arizona. Terry Anderson has passed away at the age of 76. So Julie Pace, senior vice president and executive editor of the AP, putting out a statement. Terry was deeply committed to on-the-ground eyewitness reporting and demonstrated great bravery and resolve both in his journalism and during his years held hostage. We are so appreciative of the sacrifices he and his family made as a result of his work. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.